as commander, what were your principal problems in terms of command and control?
Well, first of all, it was a multinational force of great complexity, in the sense that we ended up with 34 nations in the force, many of whom, I'm not sure whether it's a majority or not, but many of whom were on their first United Nations mission. And while they came at it with a clear idea that this was going to contribute to their role in the New World Order, they, in many instances, had only a very fundamental idea of what it was they were there for. And they came from different cultural bases, some of them from cultural bases where the circumstances in their own country were, in some instances, at least as bad, if not worse, than the Cambodian countryside. And of course we had situations where the Germans and the Japanese engaged on their first military operation since the Second World War outside their country, were very sensitive. So there was huge press interest from all in this, and at the same time, there was also an explosion of UN activity with Somalia and Yugoslavia and so on, and a lot of the effort that might have been applied to Cambodia was absorbed by these other missions. So it was stitching together a military organisation from a very fundamental basis in a very short period of time. I was well served by my personal staff in this respect. We put out some very clear directions about this to the nations in order to help them to prepare their forces. And our standing operating procedures were very prescriptive without being inflexible. And they were all put out beforehand. A great deal of effort went into that. But getting people onto the ground and getting them focused on exactly what it was they were supposed to do, when many of them had just come to survive and do the thing and go home, was quite difficult. And then the idea that they weren't there on some sort of a jolly peacekeeping activity, that this was going to be something which was done in an insecure environment, was a very difficult idea to get around. The other problem was to develop a multinational headquarters in which everybody had a sense of participating and a sense of confidence in the outcomes and a sense of contributing. That took some time to do. And I had to put in place a whole series of mechanisms which were demanding on the staff, but which built up that level of confidence. The problems are enormous, in fact, but at the end of the day, and I've said this on many occasions, everyone actually wanted to be respected for what they were doing, their military endeavour, and for their nations to earn respect. And probably the principal tool in getting people to do what you wanted was to say, look, what you're doing is unprofessional, and it's going to cast your nation, your military, in a bad light. This is what you should do in order to generate respect from the international community and the Cambodians themselves. And people, at the end of the day, were very proud about what they'd have achieved. On the way to that success, we had many, many disruptions, and we had to send a number of people home, in some cases major components of the various peacekeeping forces. But it was a military leadership endeavour of the most demanding type.
You've hinted at this question already, but to what extent were standard operating procedures effectively observed in UNTAC?
Let me say that a lot of the forces came from a different policy base into Cambodia. That was one of the sort of revelations to me, coming from a country where there is a single policy base for the employment of its military forces outside the country. To find that there were military forces there that were operating on different strands of policy that came from different parts of their executive. For example, you could have a part of a military force which was responding to a strand of policy that came from the defence, a part of it which was responding to a strand of policy which came from the presidential palace, and a part of it which was responding to a strand of policy which came from the Department of Foreign Affairs. And it was quite difficult to determine which of these was influencing their reaction to the situations in the countryside and indeed their reaction to the standing operating procedures, which made it all the more important that I appealed to their military pride in their uniform and their professionalism to overcome those things. Some were able to overcome it more easily than others because they were a little bit more remote from their country and the hand of their own operational commanders did not rely as heavily on them. But I did have elements which actually were sending intelligence or information they picked up in the countryside home and not providing it to the military component headquarters. And we became very conscious of that. I mean, fortunately, we knew what we were doing, and there was a parallel body of observers as well as the military components around the countryside. So we were able, in the nicest possible way, to identify where people were failing to comply with the operating procedures and to put them on a path which would bring them back onto it. And at the end of the day, that's where they had to be for their own security and for the security of everybody around them. And those that were most vulnerable were those that didn't comply. And I think probably the history of UNTAC reveals that.
Finally, a couple of questions linking Cambodia and other UN peacekeeping operations. Firstly, were there previous UN operations on which you drew as lessons going into Cambodia?
I think Cambodia was a paradigm. There was nothing much from previous UN operations, except in the nature of the UN administrative processes, which we could draw lessons from. And try to change. I mean, the UN administration processes are very bureaucratic and cumbersome, and a number of those things had to be changed in order to conduct an operation of this complexity and magnitude. If I drew on any operations for my experience, they were things like the Malayan emergency and confrontation and so on, and the combination of civic action, political objectives, military objectives, the fusing together of these things to achieve outcomes. I mean, Templar's role in and conduct of the operations in the Malayan emergency, which brought Malaya to independence and the establishment of of an effective Malayan constitution and government, would be the primary operation from which I drew my understanding of what was required in Cambodia. If you look back on the UN operations which preceded this, the only one that came anywhere near this was the Namibia operation, which was a much smaller activity. It did have some observance of borders, some control and disarming of military, and some assistance with the conduct of an election. But the idea of taking over a whole country, creating an electorate, creating political parties, creating an atmosphere in remote countryside which has been torn by war on this scale was without precedent. And I think the lessons that came from it are very vital to the future, not simply of the United Nations, but global stability.
And can you say a little bit about those major lessons which you drew from Cambodia for future UN operations?
Well, let me say, the first thing is that these are very complex military operations. They're very complex military civil operations, and you cannot run them from a secretariat. If you're going to run operations of this complexity and magnitude, you have to have a proper headquarters organization, which is in the business of anticipating the needs of the operation, planning for it, establishing a proper link between operations in the field and policymakers, such as the Security Council represents, and anticipating the needs of people in the field and giving effect to those needs in order to avoid crises. Now, the UN has made a half-hearted effort to recognise that reality, but I think there's great concern that if the UN could do that, it would be something other than the UN. And I think there's evidence of this. It lies in the fact that it's been NATO that has conducted the activities in the former Yugoslavia, pushing aside really the United Nations when it got down to decisive military civic action. There's some perils in that, of course. Using NATO rather than strengthening the hand of the United Nations actually pushes us towards a regional approach to things, which is not much better than what existed before we had the United Nations. The other aspect, and I've mentioned it here, is the need for a strategic alliance between the civil agencies. That's not simply the UN humanitarian agencies, but all the civil agencies, including the non-government agencies and the military. You have to produce a planning environment and an operating environment which is conducive to that coordination of the objectives of those organisations. Otherwise, the resources are frittered away, and you can find these organisations pursuing objectives which are contrary to those of each other. The other issue, and it's a clear issue, is that you cannot conduct these operations unless you forge an alliance between the people who are the beneficiary of these operations and the United Nations force or organisation. And there's the rub. I mean, the most serious issue confronting the United Nations is that it has a charter which is about nation states in a liberal world where the sovereignty of the nation states is totally respected, and yet most of the global problems can't be handled on a simple nationally defined boundary condition. Mm-hmm. That there has to be an international dynamic which enables the problems of peoples, regions, to be addressed in a total international economic, social, cultural and military context.
General Sanderson, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.